you know, and Mickey's, I mean, she's invested a lot of her life in this, and she's upset.
Absolutely.
She's leaving. It's not about her. Yeah, I do too. I spent a lot of my life. I've been involved over 15 years.
I didn't. House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, May 18, 2011. We will, on the agenda, we will not be having a hearing on Senate Bill 347A or Senate Bill 592A. We need a little more work. We're ready to go. Open a public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 378. Yale Meyer and Brad Berry, please.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 378A requires the state to inform defendants of intent to rely on enhancement fact in writing no later than 60 days after the defendant is arraigned or waives arraignment or held for, following a preliminary hearing, or 14 days before trial, whichever is earlier. Creates an exception if the parties agree or if the court finds a good cause for a later date. Declares an emergency as effective on passage. This measure comes from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association to achieve a greater certainty with regard to the receipt of the state's intent with regard to enhancement.
Fire.
Thank you, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Thank you. Senate Bill 378 is one of OCDLA's bills, and it was important to us for a reason I'll be explaining in just a moment. This relates to sentencing under the sentencing guidelines. As the committee knows, that under the guidelines, the defendant, once you calculate their prior history and the criminal seriousness rating of the crime, they end up in a grid block. But if the judge decides that they want, the judge has the authority to depart upward or downward, and if they depart upward, they can exceed the presumptive sentence by as much as doubling it. So if your presumptive range was 51 to 55 months, the court could double that. They can do it based on what's called aggravating factors. The United States Supreme Court has determined that there are due process rights that attach to that. The jury has to determine those factors, and they need to find them beyond a reasonable doubt. What this bill deals with is timing. At what time does the state have to give the defense notice that it will intend to rely upon an aggravating factor? Our existing statute reads that the state must give that time with that notice within a reasonable time, and that's been the problem. That kind of has proven to be no time frame at all. There have been cases where the defense has received emails or facsimiles the day before trial, which then causes the court to have to continue matters in order to allow the defense appropriate time to actually prepare. So what Senate Bill 378 does is that it sets up a concrete time frame. This was achieved through several contentious work groups with the DAs. It was sort of like having 36 different droplets of mercury on the table, and you were trying to get them all into one congealed sense. It was tough, but we did it. Senate Bill 378 does do, as it sets up the time frame that the notice, the state must give notice no less than 60 days after arraignment on the indictment, and or 14 days prior to trial, whichever is sooner. And we had to do that because sometimes the defendant's in custody, and then you have to work backwards from the trial date, but in most instances you'll be moving forward from the arraignment date. And then there's an escape valve if the unknown crops up. So a later time, a shorter time can be allowed, either by mutual agreement of the parties or by order of the court for good cause shown. We think that this set time frame will promote fairness to the defense and also promote judicial efficiencies. We think it also assists in giving clarity to the district attorneys as to when they must do this. And it passed out of the Senate 30-0, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Berry.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, the district attorneys, as Ms. Meyer mentioned, were involved in the work group on this. This bill is quite a bit different than it originally started out, which caused problems for us. The timing on all this really deals with two factors from a DA's perspective. One is...
And could you state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. I am Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney, and I chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. I think that's the first time I've forgotten that this session. I apologize. As I started to say, there are two principal factors that deal with the timing of notice on these enhancement factors. One has to do with the ability, really, of a DA's office to get to it, find it, do the research that involves coming up with the factors and giving notice to the defense. The other has to do with the timing of when the enhancement factors actually become known to the defense. And as we had discussions, it's not uncommon that in trial prep, as a lawyer, as the deputy DA is preparing for trial and talking with witnesses, that in fact information will become known late in the game, where it actually amounts to an enhancement factor. For example, further harm to a victim. Once you're prepping a victim interviewing a victim for the purposes of trial, they may give you other information which might amount to an enhancement factor, or the wrongdoing you find that the defendant had done from the time they were originally arraigned to the time they come to trial. So as we looked at the time frames, we were always looking from trial date back. The defense, I think understandably so, was looking for a time frame more up front, more from arraignment out, and this is the compromise we came to. I do want to make it clear that as we discussed it, we all were in agreement that the court should have the ability to make a good cause showing for a late notice of an enhancement factor, and that's to deal with those exact things that I just mentioned. Information coming to the state late in the game that they reasonably could not have been expected to have known earlier.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Hicks.
Yeah, I guess the only enhancement factor I can think, I mean, not only, but the one that would come closest to mind is lack of remorse. I mean, that's the kind of thing evidence comes in after the fact. You pick up a jail telephone call, they're gloating about the crime, something like that. But I mean, and so I think that's probably covered in the good cause exception. The rest of the enhancement factors, I can't think of any reason why we wouldn't know, basically, initially or in 60 days.
Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, members of the committee, I think there are others that actually could come up. For example, and I'm sure you saw this, criminal history listings are inherently inaccurate, and it can take some time to verify what is a conviction and what is not a prior conviction. Additionally, during trial prep, for example, you're talking with a victim, you may find out, well, he got convicted of doing that same thing in Texas last year, and we've never known it because it didn't show up. There are other, I'm certain we could look at each one, and I could probably come up with one. You're right. Most should be known within 60 days. It does put a due diligence requirement on the state to look into these things in advance, and so I don't have a problem with all that. I think fairness says the factor should be noticed to the defense within a reasonable time, and we're comfortable with these time frames.
Thank you. Anything further? Thank you. Close the public
Thank you.
Hearing. Senate Bill 378, open a work session on Senate Bill 378.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 378 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hicks moves Senate Bill 378 as A to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Wisnett, would you like to carry that one for us?
Yes.
Representative Wisnett will be carried. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 408.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 408A modifies juvenile sex offender registration requirements. It removes registration requirement for juvenile sex offenders adjudicated of Class A misdemeanors, allows juvenile sex offenders adjudicated of Class C felonies to apply for relief from their obligation to report within 30 days of the end of jurisdiction, and if granted, requires the obligation to end simultaneous with the end of jurisdiction. Permits juveniles adjudicated of Class A and B felonies to apply for relief any time after 2 years have passed from termination of jurisdiction. Declares an emergency, is effective on passage. At the dais, the members, you will have just received amendments to another bill that's on today, 68, Senate Bill 68, and the amendments are the dash ones. These are conflict amendments that relate to Senate Bill 408. If both should pass, the amendment to Senate Bill 68 would resolve the conflict so that both measures would coexist. So just so you're aware, and we'll be getting to Senate Bill 68 later in today's agenda. I believe this Senate Bill 408 represents a consensus between youth rights and justice organizations and the district attorneys who participated in those discussions, and that they're here to testify today.
Thank you. I call Mark McKechnie, Christine Herman, and Janet Arnez, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We are a nonprofit law firm in Portland, and we have represented over 50,000 children and youth in the juvenile court system in both child dependency and juvenile delinquency cases. Senate Bill 408A is our top priority for this session. We see the impact directly on youth of Oregon's current registry laws. There are, just to give you a sense of the scope of this issue, there are roughly 3,000 people in Oregon who are registered due to a juvenile adjudication. We know, and it has become much more clear since these laws were originally passed, that the vast majority of those people, many of them who are now adults, long after their offense has occurred, are extremely low risk to reoffend, and they have the lowest reoffense rates of any type of offender you can think of. The rates range in the literature between 5% and 14%, and tend to land right around 7% in most studies. So extremely low rates of reoffense. On the other hand, only 13% of people who've been required to register as juveniles have been able to use the current relief statutes to get off the registry. So there's a significant gap between the number of people on the registry that we know pose little or no risk to the community, yet continue to be required to register year after year. And being on the registry has a serious impact on their lives, restricting their ability to get housing or to get jobs, and to essentially have normal lives and normal social connections. And all the literature tells us that those are the very things that would mitigate any existing risk, that people need those normal social connections and social supports, and they need to have a livelihood in order to be safe and productive members of society. I don't want to dwell too much on this because I know Christine is going to talk a little bit about this, but there's actually an inverse relationship with the scope of the registry, how many people a state requires to register, and the value of the registry for public safety purposes. When the net is cast so broadly and so many people are required to register, and particularly juveniles who often committed their acts many, many years ago, half a lifetime ago or more for many of them, that we're essentially watering down any potential public safety benefit of the registry when we do that. I want to go over what the bill does. If you've looked at the bill, it weighs in at about 23 pages. However, it's far less complex than it appears on the surface. A lot of the bold text you see is actually existing statutory language that's simply being moved from one section to another. So I'll go over the things that are changing, the substantive policy changes in the bill. It removes misdemeanors from the types of offenses that will require registration for a juvenile who is adjudicated. And I want to reemphasize that we are only talking about adjudications in juvenile court, not cases where juveniles are waived to adult court or automatically charged as adults under Measure 11. This bill does not affect those cases in any way. So there are about roughly 10% of people on the registry as juveniles who are there for misdemeanor offenses. Another important thing that this does is to remove the 3-year time limit for applying for relief from registration. We've received calls from many people who either didn't know at all what the process in Oregon was for applying for relief, or they were unfortunately in the position where the relief statute said one thing when they were originally involved in the juvenile system, and it changed somewhere since then, and By the time they found out what the new law said, they had passed the current three-year time limit and currently have no option to apply for relief. These are people who are in their late 20s and early 30s, and they may have been adjudicated when they were 12 or 13 years old. So this removes the three-year time limit for them to apply for relief. Currently, all juvenile registrants have to wait 2 years after jurisdiction to apply for relief. That remains the case for youth adjudicated of A and B felonies. For Class C felonies, the agreement we made with the District Attorneys Association was to move up the opportunity to apply for relief for youth adjudicated of Class C felonies to no sooner than 30 days before the end of juvenile court jurisdiction. That's typically the time that a youth is completing treatment, looking at being discharged from probation or being released from either close custody or a treatment program. And it's actually a perfect time for the court to consider whether they deserve to be relieved from registration. The court will have very complete and accurate and up-to-date information about pretty much every aspect of the youth's life at that time, and it allows those youth to get relief from registration right at the time that they normally would be moving from the more limited posting that applies to juveniles under jurisdiction to being put on the list with everyone else, including adult offenders. And I know that you're very familiar with that distinction based on your conversations about Senate Bill 67 and your concerns that people who were adjudicated as juveniles might be posted very publicly, and you're questioning whether that's appropriate. So this allows for C felonies a person to get relief from registration right before that time that they would go on the more public registry. And then the other thing about this bill that changes relates to people who move from out of state who are adjudicated by a juvenile court in another state. That's an aspect that I think makes the bill more confusing than it would be otherwise, because we had to figure out how to handle those types of folks and make sure there weren't equal protection problems by treating someone who was adjudicated in Oregon different from somebody who moved in from another state. And so the main change for them is obviously the people who are adjudicated of misdemeanors wouldn't have to register in Oregon. The other is that we give them 6 months if they were adjudicated in another state of a C felony offense that would require registration in Oregon. We give them 6 months to either apply for relief or to register by the end of that 6 months. I want to briefly go over the charts that are attached to my testimony before I finish. The first chart shows a statewide study of all juvenile offenders of any serious type of offense in that state. You could see that 249 of them were adjudicated of a sex-related offense, 1,780 were adjudicated of all other types of what they classified for the study as serious offenses. And they followed them 5 years after release or discharge from the juvenile system. And what they found was that basically the original charge told us nothing about their likelihood to commit a sex offense in the future, that the rates of committing those types of offenses 5 years later after they leave the juvenile system was very low for both groups, but the other striking thing is that it was essentially statistically the same for both groups, 6% for the larger group and 7% for the smaller group who had a previous sex offense. So it shows that just because someone commits one of these types of offenses as a youth, it doesn't mean they're likely to continue that behavior in the future as an adult. The next page shows you the universe we're talking about. In 2009, there were 227 youth adjudicated of these types of offenses, and you can see the disposition for those offenses. I think it's very notable that almost two-thirds of youth committed of these types of offenses are placed on probation. They remain in the community during the course of their jurisdiction. So they are already living in the community. Assuming they're successful, they stay in the community. Most of them stay in the community. And they're able to be safe in the community. They would be revoked if they weren't. And so they already have a track record, even by the time jurisdiction ends, that they can remain safely in the community. The last paragraphs I wanted to point out are, and this was at a point in time in the fall, there are more juveniles registered now because it's a lifetime registry and we keep adding to the registry. At that time, only 366 out of the 2,780 people required to register for juvenile adjudications had ever obtained relief under current or previous statutes since the registry was created. So our relief statutes that we have currently simply are not working to allow relief when it's appropriate. Given that 90%+ of them will be low risk, it's simply a failure of the current statute that only 13% have successfully obtained relief. And you can see that there's not a very close correlation between the severity of the original offense and the likelihood of relief. You actually see more people who committed more serious offenses getting relief than the less serious offenses. And with that, I'll conclude, and I'm glad to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from me?
Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Christine Herman, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force. We are a statewide organization that is dedicated to improving the response to and prevention of sexual violence. We are known primarily as a victim-centered organization. We're very proud of that, and our membership approaches all aspects of the issues related to sexual violence from a victim-centered perspective. And it is from that perspective that I am here today in support of Senate Bill 408. It is clear from the many years of study that sex offender registry in general is a failed effort at improving public safety. When you talk about juveniles, the issue is even more complicated. What we want is for sex offenders to be caught when they're young. What we know is that sex offenders who offend as adults didn't start as adults, they started as children. And so the best opportunity for rehabilitation is if they're caught young and they're offered the services necessary to succeed. That's what the juvenile justice system is all about, is getting kids into treatment. And that treatment, as you just heard, has been shown to be quite effective with juveniles. And what we don't want is any type of barrier to their success. And one of the biggest barriers to success is the sex offender registry. That registration that follows a child for the rest of his life can make it impossible to get certain jobs. You can't get federal funding for college. There are many other aspects of that registry that impact the offender, and I want to make it really clear that I would probably be arguing that's worth it, that it's worth it to impact the offender to that degree if there were a consequence to public safety that were measurable and worthwhile, but there simply is not. There is no indication that the registry is helping public safety. In fact, there's indication, as you've heard, that it's hindering public safety. Most offenders are never caught. We know that for sure. It does tend to give us a sense of safety that's false when we believe that we can simply look at a list and determine who all the bad people are. That's just it's not true. And that's no more true with adults than children. I also think that it's important to remember that the reasons people offend, particularly the younger they are complex and varying, and one-size-fits-all efforts to stop them don't work. At least this idea of public registry came into vogue in the 90s, and the idea was to impact public safety, and it has not. I also want to clarify and make it very clear that this in no way would change the public record of the offense, of the conviction. And so there's always going to be a public record of the conviction that is quite separate and apart from the public registry, which is a different animal altogether. So we aren't hiding the fact that an offense happened from people in the future who need to know that information. So I am happy to answer any questions, and I applaud the Youth Rights and Justice Project, which I still want to call something else, for their efforts in bringing forward this legislation.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Herman. Any questions, Ms. Herman? Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the opportunity to appear this afternoon. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We represent $180 million worth of small business in Oregon, 7,000 employees, and 95,000 children. In addition to my comments today, you'll also see attached comments from two of our juvenile justice providers who have sex offender treatment programs. Janice is one of the largest treatment provider in the state for these youth. I don't want to reiterate too much of the information because we're on short time. But it is very clear that these youth, that everything that the registry is intended to do actually inhibits their ability to be able to get a job, go to work, be responsible, have housing, and to be the kind of citizen that we want them to be. And with the lowest possible recidivism rates of offenses that juveniles have to address, it seems counterintuitive that we wouldn't want to amend the current registry. Janice, for example, on their younger youth, have a 0% recidivism rate when they're able to get them in treatment and keep them in treatment. And treatment lasts 6 to 8 years, and many of these kids are incarcerated even before they go into treatment. On their older youth, their recidivism rate is 2%. The Youth Guidance Association, which is also attached, they reference a 5% recidivism rate. So these are very low numbers, even lower in Oregon than they are in the national average. So we urge your support for the passage of the bill.
Any questions? Thank you, panel. Your testimony. Elizabeth Kushwa and Vi Beatty, please. Ms. Kushwa, if you go ahead and go first, please.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Elizabeth Kushwa. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 408. I'd also especially like to thank Maura Roach and Mark McKechnie for working so diligently with the district attorneys and making the changes that we had requested along the line. This really was a good cooperative solution. I'd like to make one correction to Mr. McKechnie's statement about C felonies. He said they can be relieved 30 days before the end of jurisdiction. They can apply for relief. They can't be relieved until they've successfully completed jurisdiction. In addition, I'd like to note that relief is not mandated. Actually, the process remains the same. It's just the timelines that have changed on this bill. The window that had been the three-year window from 2 years to 5 years, in other words, 2 years after jurisdiction could be youth could apply for relief, and that window only stayed open for 3 years. That was actually when the adult statute changed, not changed in the juvenile statute. It makes no sense to have a window on juveniles like that. We definitely wanted to keep that window open. You've heard exactly what the bill does from other testimony today, so I will sit here and take your questions if you have any.
Representative Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just because I'm not all that familiar with criminal law, can you describe some, in appropriate terms, some garden variety misdemeanors that under current law would require registration but under this bill would not require registration?
Chair Barker, Representative Ron, I'd like to phone a friend. Thanks so much.
Okay, you've used one of your lifelines.
Yes. I'm running out of them.
For the record, I'm Bradbury, Yamhill County DA, and chair of the Legislative Committee for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. You caught me cold, but the offenses, I think the list of offenses that are not registerable is shorter, and that includes sexual harassment and it's not contributing, and sex abuse 3. And the other misdemeanor sex offenses are registrable offenses, including contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor.
Can I follow up?
Please.
So let me just unpack that because I didn't understand most of it.
Okay.
So I'm looking at this, and it shows that under current law, misdemeanor sex offenses are registerable. Under SB 408, they're not. And so just so I understand your answer, Sex Abuse 3 and one other would no longer require registration. But I don't know what Sex Abuse 3 entails.
Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, Representative Juan, Sex Abuse 3 is a touching between individuals, and it deals with age difference between them. So, again, I prefer to have the statute in front of me because they're all just a little bit different, but that's essentially what it is.
Thank you. That answers my question. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate your whack at it.
Okay. Thank you. Excuse me, allergies. 163-415. I do happen to have the statute available. Sex abuse three. It says the person commits this crime if they subject another person to sexual contact. The victim does not consent to the contact. The victim is incapable of consent for reason of being under 18 years of age. That's one option. Or it's for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire of the person or the other person, or intentionally propelling dangerous substance at the victim. Now, I think within that statute, it is either registerable or not, depending on which direction we go. Because remember I said there's two different directions. One direction is the victim is incapable of consent by reason of being under 18 years of age. My recollection is that one is not currently registerable. I'm going off a recollection here, but I think that's right. However, if the person commits the contact, which can be over clothes or under, for the purpose of arousing or gratifying the sexual desire, I believe that is currently registerable. So there's one little loophole, if you will, within the Sex Abuse 3 misdemeanor currently existing. The other one is the harassment statute, which is for it's offensive physical contact of a sexual or intimate part of the body, which is not, to my knowledge, registerable at this time. The C felonies are really what's in play here. Currently, it's registerable under the standard. That isn't really going to be a big change, is what I'm saying, in terms of the misdemeanors. It's not a big change. The C felonies, there's a change there. What's being changed, and this is Sex Abuse 2, for example, I don't want to go any further and say there's any other C felony.
We can talk more.
What's that?
We can talk more after.
Yeah, we can. So anyway, that's, they're comfortable with it. I'm comfortable with it also.
Thank you. No further questions. Thank you. And one thing I would like to say, I'd like to thank the district attorneys and the other groups for getting together and getting this thing cleaned up before you brought it before us today. And that saves everybody a lot of time and trouble. Ms. Beatty, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Vi Beatty. I'm the manager of the Oregon State Sex Offender Registry with Oregon State Police. I'm here in a neutral capacity to provide information. Currently, we have 2,750 youth who are required to register as active registrants living, working, or attending school in the state of Oregon. There are actually over 3,100 juveniles on the registry. The variable amount are those who have left the state and are currently located somewhere else. 210 of those 2,750 youth would be removed immediately because they have misdemeanor adjudications currently. There are 427 youth living in the state of Oregon, working in the state of Oregon, or attending school in the state of Oregon, who we would be reviewing for a crime equate to see would they be relieved under that misdemeanor piece. We have a year to remove them under the current version of the bill, so there is a very minimal fiscal impact to Oregon State Police. One thing I'd like to put on the record is I'm unaware of any studies that have been done regarding whether registration assists or negates public safety. So I'd like to see any study that there is out there because I have been unable to find any. What you have before you is a breakdown of what the current law requires and what 408 would require. As Mr. McKechnie said, misdemeanors would be immediately removed. Class C felonies then, of course, fall into that petition for relief 30 days, beginning 30 days before the end of their period. The registration pieces all remain the same. The relief available is, of course, the misdemeanors in Class C, and then for A's and B's, it stays the same as it currently is. They have to register for 2 years past their termination date with the juvenile court. Then they can petition the court. The five-year cap is removed. Under 181830, which is the, we refer to Romeo and Juliet, certain circumstances relief, there is no change whatsoever.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Coacher. This probably is for staff. And as Ms. Beatty stated under the current version of this bill, 408, they would be removing from the list persons previously convicted. But does that actually require the Dash 1 amendment? I haven't had a chance to digest this fully. Is that the purpose of the Dash 1 amendment? I know it connects it, but...
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hicks, yeah, the Dash 1 amendment I referred to earlier was the bill with which 408 conflicts. 408 has no... It's 408A engrossed from the other chamber, and there is no amendment to the 408. The Dash 1 to 68, which we're here today, makes no substantive change and doesn't affect the substance of 408.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. Close the public. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 408 and open a work session on Senate Bill 408A.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 408.
No amendments.
No amendment? No. Just as it is?
Yeah.
Okay. Move 408 as amended. Add to the floor.
Representative Krieger moves 408A to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Yes.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wigman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson, would you carry that bill for us, please?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 616A.
Senate Bill 616A allows a court to include animals within the scope of a protective order issued pursuant to the Family Abuse Prevention Act, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Okay, Scott Beckstead, Matthew Dominguez, and Glenn Kolb, please.
Thank you. Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is Scott Beckstead. I'm the Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. I live in North Douglas County in the nice little town of Sutherland. Here today to speak in strong support of Senate Bill 616-A. By way of the history on this bill, the bill passed unanimously out of the Senate Judiciary Committee and passed through the House on a vote of 28-2. The amendment to the bill was achieved through mutual efforts by myself and Senator Whitsitt. The amendment was aimed primarily to make sure that judges were not litigating title to commercial ranching livestock in the context of Family Abuse Prevention Act proceedings. So you will notice that the bill specifies that the animals that would be subject to these restraining orders are animals that are kept primarily for companionship, personal protection, or therapy animals. The link between domestic violence and cruelty to animals has been well established and is gaining a growing amount of recognition in the law. There are currently 17 other states around the country that have adopted statute similar to this so that animals can be provided for in domestic violence restraining orders. The fact is that when a victim of domestic violence has an animal that she or he cares for, that provides the abuser with an additional means of controlling and abusing that victim. And furthermore, when the victim of domestic violence has an animal in the household or owns an animal that they care about, they are less likely to leave an abusive relationship and seek help for fear of the safety of those animals. My spouse served as the animal control officer for the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office, and in her line of work, she saw these kinds of scenarios, two cases in particular, one involving a man who threw his elderly mother's dog down a stairwell and broke the dog's legs in plain sight of the elderly mother, another case where a man brutally killed a mother cat and her kittens in front of his daughter. The fact is that this is an animal welfare issue. Obviously, we want to protect animals from harm, but this is also very much a human safety issue because the link between the suffering imposed by domestic violence and the suffering that can be inflicted through animals is well established. I can tell you, members of the committee, that there is a strong need for this bill. The fact is, anecdotally, we heard that some judges in Oregon would take the initiative and actually write in provisions relating to protection of animals, but other judges refused to grant that relief because they simply didn't feel they had the express statutory authority to do so. And this obviously provides much needed clarification. Again, 17 other states have passed similar legislation overwhelmingly, and we feel that it's time for Oregon to do so as well. And I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, committee members. My name is Glenn Culp. I'm director with the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and we also are here in support of Senate Bill 660A. You know, in our profession, one thing that is pretty abundantly clear, we see that shared connection that animals and people have, and it's a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, there's some people who harm animals and abuse animals. And in Oregon, there are about 1.8 million dogs and cats in the state, with approximately 57% of the households home to these animals. And I think as Oregonians, we can be proud that we're among one of the best states in the nation with our animal protection laws. We do fall short of protecting animals, mostly pets, that are caught in the middle of domestic violence. We know that batterers threaten. We know that batterers abuse. We know that batterers kill animals. And it's to just demonstrate and exert their control, confirm their power over the victim. Senate Bill 616A is an important tool to address this serious matter. We believe that on a showing of good cause, that the court should have the discretion to include animals in restraining orders under the Family Abuse Protection Act, and we hope that you also agree that Oregon is time to join 17 other states to issue a similar bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Matthew Dominguez. I live in Southwest Portland, and I'm currently attending Lewis and Clark Law School. Domestic violence involves a complex range of destructive behaviors. This includes physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, in addition with intimidation and threats. The primary goal underlying these behaviors is control, is to get control over one's partner. To gain control, abusers will take any opportunity to intimidate their victims, and unfortunately, this includes the use of pets. As Scott mentioned, the link between domestic violence and animal abuse is well documented, and SB 616 is one tool to combat that link. Victims of domestic violence are often left in a horrible position, whether to stay in an abusive household and often dangerous situation, or to leave, but leave their beloved pets behind. SB 616 helps eliminate this barrier, this horrible choice, by allowing judges to include animals in protective orders. Dr. Frank Ascione from the University of Denver, who is a prominent scientist in regards to the link, has reported that 71% of victims in women's shelters report that abusers have either harmed, killed, or threatened a family pet. Additional research has shown that 48% of battered women have delayed leaving or returned to an abuser out of fear and safety for their pets. In 2008, I was part of the 17th annual Animal Law Conference at Lewis and Clark Law School, and one of the panels that I put together was to explore the link between domestic violence and animal abuse. Dr. Frank Ascione was one of the people that came on the panel, but we also had a sole practitioner that from Michigan who told a story that has resonated with me, and I'd like to share it with you. So you have a husband and a wife and two children, 4 and 6 years old, a daughter and a son. The husband, very abusive man, he every couple months he would like to go to the local pet store and adopt two adorable, cute little kittens. Shortly after bringing them home, he would name the kittens after his children, let them bond with them for a couple months, and then shortly after that bond was created, he would pull them into the living room and kill the cats in front of the children. Now, the purpose of this story isn't to highlight the animal cruelty, but to highlight the extent that an abuser will go to gain control over the people that they abuse, in particular, the violence towards animals. SB 616 protects women, children, and pets by recognizing the love and the attachment humans have for their pets, while also addressing the fact that abusers will use that affection to intimidate, harass, and control their victims. Therefore, I fully support SB 616 and urge the committee and the full Senate to swiftly pass this into law. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions to this panel? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Doug Harkleroad and Deborah Wood, please.
Chairs Barker and Krieger, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Harkleroad. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance, and the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance supports this bill. Steve Dole also wanted you to know, for the sake of time, he's not testifying, but Crime Victims United also supports this bill. I've passed out written testimony, which is comparable to much that's been said already. I shan't do that. Talk about that. I will tell you one brief story. The last case I tried in 2008 was a domestic violence case. And when I was interviewing the victim of this domestic violence, by the way, there was a child present, so it was a felony, she told me about the cat that the defendant had hung in their storage shed with his boot shoelace. It was a tough case. It was a no-body homicide, so to speak. I filed it anyway, lost that count, convicted him of the more serious count, and he went to prison. The reason I tell that story is because these are very, very closely connected, and allowing a judge to protect the animal in that restraining order to stop the abuse of the animal as well as the spouse and the children is very important. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairpersons, my name is Deborah Wood. I am the Manager of Animal Services for Washington County. I've submitted written testimony, and I won't repeat the information you've already had. But I would like to just give a quick piece of why, on the ground, it makes a difference. We have a multidisciplinary team in Washington County for animal protection that includes our district attorney's office, the Domestic Violence Resource Center, the Department of Human Services with the state of Oregon, ourselves, the Beaverton Police, as well as the Oregon Humane Society and other animal and people nonprofits. And we are looking at really being proactive about dealing with these issues. And at the Bonnie L. Hayes Small Animal Shelter in Washington County, we will provide safe haven for a pet of a victim of domestic violence if it allows them to get out of the situation that they're in. In past years, when people came to us and basically presented the scenario, if the dog was licensed to the abuser, and abusers are the kind of people that make sure the dog is licensed to them, we would just have to throw up our hands and say, well, the dog is licensed to, you know, the person you say you're afraid of. We were able now now to, by working with our multidisciplinary team, we've had two situations where women have come to us. The best example, a woman came and had two cats. Her ex-boyfriend was getting out of jail that day after serving time for physically abusing her and had told her that he was going to kill her cats. She came to the shelter. We sent her forward to the district attorney's victim advocate program, and she was able to get a restraining order. And again, it's, as Scott Beckstead said, it's the toss of a coin whether a judge will do it. But in this case, the judge did include her cats in the restraining order. We sent an animal services officer to the home of the ex-boyfriend, was able to pick up the two cats with legal protection for us doing so, and with another nonprofit, cared for the cats for 2 months while she was able to get permanent housing and get her cats back. So the difference between having a restraining order or not is enormous, and it's real, and we would ask you to pass this bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Thank you. Close the public hearing, open the work session on Senate Bill 616A.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 616A to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 616A to the floor if it do pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Yes.
Representative Wong.
No.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Would somebody like to carry that bill?
I will.
Representative Tomei, please. Be the carrier. Open a work session on Senate Bill 62.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 62 was previously heard on April 26th. It has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. It's a measure that approves the Criminal Justice Commission's adoption of its administrative rules and its amendments of several other of its administrative rules. Statutes require the commission to review legislative changes to criminal laws and adopt and modify administrative rules consistent with such changes and to submit those modifications to this body for approval. So Senate Bill 62 comes from the Criminal Justice Commission and represents its compliance with the statute.
Okay, is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 62 to the floor if the due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 62 to the floor if the due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Excused.
Representative
Olson. Aye. Representative
Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative
Tomei. Aye.
Representative
Wong. No.
Representative
Wisman. Yay.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Would somebody like to carry that one for us?
Couldn't go to.
We have a no vote, so I don't want to.
We have a no vote.
Representative Shoffler, would you carry that for us, please?
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Open a work session on Senate Bill 63A.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 63A, you heard on April the 26th. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. This is the measure that the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision brought to condition release of persons who are on active felony supervision at the time of the offense that resulted in their incarceration on their residing for the first 6 months post-release in the county where they were previously supervised because of the benefit to them. Based on the testimony of having a pre-existing supervisory relationship and going back to it. The measure allows for exceptions and codifies what's in existing practice between the board and the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections in a patchwork fashion and puts it into statute.
Okay, is there any discussion on this one?
Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 63A to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 63A to the floor with the due pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry that one. Open to work session on Senate Bill 64.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 64 was previously heard on April the 27th. It has no revenue and no fiscal. This is the one that limits the applicability of the Uniform Act on Blood Tests to determine paternity in criminal matters to criminal non-support cases. It applies retroactively. It was brought from the Department of State Police to change just that section of the Act that makes it applicable to criminal cases to non-support only. It was an issue of the Act specifically naming bodies that could accredit a laboratory, and Oregon's forensic laboratories are accredited by a body that was not named, which had the effect of prohibiting them from conducting the paternity tests in criminal cases. This will allow them to do that.
Any discussion?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 64 to the floor with due pass.
Okay. Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 64 to the floor with due pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Excuse.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice-Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice-Chair Garrett.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carried. Okay, Representative Krieger will carry that one. Open a work session on Senate Bill 65.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 65 was previously heard on April the 27th. No revenue impact and no fiscal impact. This is another of the measures brought by the, I believe, the Department of State Police. It recognizes the conversion ratio between a blood test and a breath test for purposes of expressing the amount of alcohol in a person's blood. In Oregon currently, a person's blood can be tested using a breath test or a blood test, but the statute requires the expression of the results of that test to be placed based on units of blood only. This would allow them to express it either way.
Okay, any discussion?
Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 65 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 65 to the floor with a due pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Excuse.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Yes.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Second.
Representative Olson, please. Thank you. Open a work session on Senate Bill 68.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 68, as I indicated, we received the conflict amendments due to a conflict with Senate Bill 408 just at the dais today, so we don't have the fiscal and revenues to move the conflict amendments into the measure. We'll have to reschedule
that. Okay, that will reschedule then. Close work session on Senate Bill 68. Open a work session on Senate Bill 178.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 178 was previously heard on the 11th. Has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. This is the measure that allows BOLI to discontinue publishing its double rate book, where it was required to compare and then publish this book on, I believe, an annual or semi-annual basis. When the numbers in the book became obsolete much more frequently, so this would allow them not to have to publish the double rate book anymore.
Yeah. Remember that? Okay, any discussion?
Only to say, Mr. Chair, if I may, for the life of me, I don't know why this goes in past business and everything.
We're going to let you carry it.
Yeah.
Well, actually, somebody else is going to carry it.
No, not this one.
Oh, that's what I was talking about.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'd be happy to carry it.
Okay. Well, we got to pass it first. Call the roll, please.
Representative
Malady.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Yes.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excused.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carries. And Representative Schaffler, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We announced earlier, if you weren't here, we're going to reset Senate Bill 347A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 397A.
Chairs and members of the committee, excuse me. Senate Bill 397A was previously heard on May the 3rd. This is the measure that allows actions based on tort to be brought against officers, employees, or agents of public bodies if the complaint alleges that the plaintiff is entitled to damages in excess of the Oregon Tort Claims Act limits. And it clarifies that the total combined recovery is limited to a single occurrence. If the members remember, attorneys from Oregon Health Sciences University came and testified about the opinion in the Clark case being concerned with foreclosure of a right of action against an individual when the tort caps were exceeded, and this Senate Bill 397A addresses that point by allowing a person's name to be carried over on the complaint, but it doesn't change the amount of damages that are available, and it doesn't change the public body's obligation to indemnify.
Great, thank you. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Nolan. Excuse. I'm sorry. Back up 1 second.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 397A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 397A to the floor with a due pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Excuse.
Representative Bolton.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
Chris.
Representative Garrett from Curry. We also announced we're resetting Senate Bill 592A, open a work session on Senate Bill 731A.
Chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 731A was heard on the 11th. There's no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact. This is the measure that was generated by a work group that addresses retention of biological evidence. It's the most recent in a series of measures that address retention and collection issues and provide a framework for dealing with DNA evidence. In 2009, Senate Bill 310A passed, affecting a moratorium on destruction of DNA evidence in certain criminal cases, and this bill refines the provisions of Senate Bill 310A and lifts that moratorium.
Any discussion? Any motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 731A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 731A to the floor with a due pass. Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Excuse.
Representative Bolton.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Excuse.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries.
Representative Olson, would you like to carry that for us, please?
Absolutely.
Thank you. No further business to come before the committee. Committee adjourned.